This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Stay tuned for details of how to get a 10% discount. Coming up today, trees are literally leaking gold, and we do mean literally, although in a forest, not actually here on the podcast. Plus, the United Nations has adopted a plan to defend Earth from threatening asteroids, and more BitTorrent sites are getting blocked by ISPs in the UK. Is yours amongst them? Find out. Plus, as a special treat, and it is very special, we've got an exclusive interview with Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak, and you're not going to want to miss that, trust me. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting, from science and tech to eucalyptus tree innovation and updates on the looming threat from the skies. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
And I'm Nicholas Tufnell.
And last week, I lied, listeners. I lied into your ears. I said that Liv and Liat would be back, but they're not. Liv's in Austria covering a conference called Pioneers Festival. Liat's in Dublin covering a conference called Web Summit. Katie's in Rwanda covering tech innovation there. She's also speaking to the Rwandan president about technology and how it's shaping that country's future. Big fans of, I don't know, shoe leather journalism, I think, as it's called. So, stepping in with the leather on his shoes, Thomas Cheshire.
Hey, Hi, Tom. Nate. How you doing?
Pleasure to have you back. Now, you've been on the show before, but never for the entire program. You've stepped in to give insight on features.
Yeah, I'm terrified.
Don't be. We're very, very friendly, aren't we, Nicholas?
Oh, very friendly.
We caress
too friendly.
You. Yeah, maybe, certainly. Stop that. So Tom's going to be talking about a cover story that he's actually written for a new issue of Wired, which is coming out this week. And he's also going to join us for the news. And let's get into that news. So, Nicholas, trees are literally leaking gold into their leaves in Australia.
So, yeah, as you rightly say, there are scientists in Australia that have discovered that some of their eucalyptus trees are literally leaking gold.
And this is into their leaves?
Into their leaves. Oh, yeah.
Dripping.
Yeah, it's not just everywhere.
Okay.
It's not a horrible mess. So, Melvin Linton and his team at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization discovered trees in Australia and throughout the world, it's not just Australia, can be used to detect gold buried up to 30 meters underground. Small amounts of gold dissolve in the water surrounding the trees, which is sucked up by the roots that go tens of meters into the ground and eventually stored in the leaves. So the trees act as a sort of hydraulic pump.
It's a little bit kind of like the leaves that go brown around this time of year are getting a little bit of a gold tint.
Exactly. If it was that much gold, it would be amazing.
Oh, right.
And we would all be fine and everyone would be rich and we could just run around in our pants and do whatever we liked. But unfortunately, it's not like that. The amount of gold produced by the trees is minuscule. Linton estimates that there'd be about 500 trees required in order to make a simple gold ring.
You know what? That's actually not as many as I would have thought.
500 trees is a lot.
I suppose it is. But to produce a gold ring. So what does this mean? I mean, are De Beers going to get on this and start making rings out of trees? Or is this just...
No. So basically... This allows quite efficient gold mining, essentially, because you can use these trees to quite easily detect rich veins and possibly mother lodes. So prior to this discovery, in order to get gold, you either had to sort of blow up bits of rock or go into a river with a rather depressing sieve and sort of just, you know...
I've done that. It is pretty depressing.
Yeah. It's not much fun and it's very time consuming and the other methods are very expensive. Whereas this... in comparison, is quite cheap. I mean, it's not, but at the same time, in comparison to blowing up, you know, rocks or using drills, etc., it is cheap. But it does require a massive X-ray machine to find these particles within the leaves, which fills the size of a room, which obviously is going to be quite expensive.
But. I'm pretty sure about like a quarter or a third or something of all gold in the world is actually in Australia.
Yeah, they have a lot of gold.
This must be pretty promising.
This is great for the Australians.
Yeah. So in the continuing adventures of high street retailers offering low-cost Android tablets, that's the weirdest premise for a film if I ever heard one, actually, the Carphone Warehouse, which neither sells car phones nor is it a warehouse, has priced its 7-inch Avoca, or however the hell you pronounce that, 7, to £49. That's a 7-inch Android tablet for under £50. Now, this is undercutting the Argos My tablet, which costs £99, and we've talked about that in the past. Funnily enough, I was chatting to Andy, my brother, who writes for CNET, just before we came on the show, and he's reviewing this and called it thoroughly disappointing, or very disappointing. He was frustrated and was thoroughly unimpressed by the Argos My tablet. And this one from Carphone Warehouse costs half that. We'll talk about the specs in a few minutes. And then the Argos one is undercutting the Huddle from Tesco, which costs £129. So this continuing adventure of incredibly cheap tablets is only getting more interesting. So this Evoca tablet from Carphone Warehouse, its 7-inch screen only has 800 by 480 pixels. That's pretty low. That would be average for kind of a mid-range smartphone at this point, let alone a 7-inch tablet. And it's got a 1 gigahertz processor, which isn't too bad, 512 meg of RAM, that's also not too bad. That's the same as the iPad mini for comparison, 8 gig of memory built in. And I think it's one of these things that's kind of getting aimed at kids. One comment that we had on the website, actually, when we published this story was, great, this will be fab for my 6-year-old. It means I can get my Google Nexus 7 back. So I think a lot of these are going to be aimed at kids. But also announced today, the Samsung has announced that the Galaxy Tab Kids is going to be on sale in November in places like Toys R Us. And it's going to have a child-friendly interface. It's going to have its own kids-focused app store. So a lot of very interesting developments happening in the retail space. Tom, when you look at these sorts of tablets, do you get excited?
I get excited because it feeds very nicely into my cover story about what digital hyperstimulation is doing to our children. But yeah, it's great. I think the earlier you get these technologies in front of kids, especially in the family environment, it's really, really good. We shouldn't be too sneery or snobbish or dismissive just because they have terrible, terrible screen resolution.
Oh, it's not just about the resolutions.
It's about everything.
It's about everything. Yeah, a lot of these tablets, they're low cost and they're very attractive because of their price points. But I imagine maybe a reason people might look to these, aside from kids, is maybe they've seen someone with an iPad or something like that, or they've seen someone's Google Nexus and they've decided they want a tablet. They want to get in on the second screen revolution, let's say, of what it's like to tweet along with the X Factor or what have you.
It's a joy.
And then they buy one of these tablets and find they're actually very, very disappointing because they are very slow, sluggish. The interface isn't good. However, this is what it takes, I think, for innovation to actually get kickstarted. It's for this sort of thing to start happening. Retailers see it as an interesting market and then they start experimenting with slightly higher specs and things like that. So it is all actually very, very good. And we haven't seen the Evoca 7 in person yet. So there's still a chance for them to impress us. But I think it's interesting. This morning, funnily enough, I saw a baby using an iPad. It was bizarre, sort of using its little hands and those tiny little fingers to sort of swipe through the screen. What's happening.
How old was the baby?
I don't know. How old are babies when they wear, what are those pants called? Nappies.
maybe our listeners can write in with the answer to that.
I don't know. It was nappy age, whatever that is.
But it's great because, when you think, if you're a kid trying to use a computer, actually to learn a computer, you need to know language and how to type and how to use maths. That's really hard. iPad, you can just get straight away into.
I think it just proves how intuitive the design is for a lot of Apple's products. But
Apple, though. I mean, it's the whole swiping touch interface. I mean, this same baby was then given a magazine and was trying to pinch to zoom on the thing. And it's like, these are the kids that are going to be investing in, these are kids that have grown up wanting to touch and swipe and pinch everything. And basically, if products in the future aren't designed knowing that that's the generation that's now being born, that's growing up, then your product's going to suffer as a result. That's why I was looking at this baby, or rather why the baby was being shown to me.
Well, we're adding pinch and zoom to the paper magazine very soon, so
oh, really?
Watch out for that. Yeah.
I just find that it's the analog style of just bring your head closer to the object.
Yeah, that's a feature.
It's what I call the manual zoom. Anyway, we're going slightly off tangent, but we will try and get reviews of all these low budget tablets on wide.co.uk soon, so look out for that. Now, Tom, you've got this story about a new plan to defend Earth from threatening asteroids that could cause all sorts of disasters in future if we're not careful.
Yeah, I think it's great that the United Nations has finally come out against being blown up. It's adopted an asteroid defense plan. They set up a group called the International Asteroid Warning Group, which I really want to join. It's a great name.
Yeah.
The idea is to let member states share information about extraterrestrial objects they suspect to be dangerous.
And one of the fun things about asteroid spotting is that a huge amount of the sort of early warnings that we get for near-Earth missiles and objects and things actually comes from amateur astronomers, not necessarily, you know, people you would expect to be watching out for these all the time, like NASA and what have you.
Yeah, I think some scientists say it's only a tiny, tiny percentage of near misses are actually detected. And so some estimate there's something like a million near-Earth asteroids that pose a risk but haven't been identified. So the idea is it's rather a large number, rather a worrying number to try and scope those out a bit more.
So what happens if they detect an asteroid?
So they form a committee. They go to the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space Group, who will coordinate missions to save the planet. So they'll probably do this by smashing spaceships into asteroids or by Bruce Willis. other methods include a gravity tractor, which is cool, or even wrapping the asteroid in a sheet of reflective plastic, such as aluminized cling film, which will act as a solar sail.
Yeah. Actually, there's some really interesting ideas around the gravity idea of basically flying stuff past these asteroids. So the shift in gravity is just enough to slightly veer it off course so it actually flies by Earth. Because blowing these things up is a really bad idea because it basically turns one giant object into smaller, multiple smaller objects.
And radioactive objects as well.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to say that whilst that the tractor idea sounds great, I much prefer to see something get blown to smithereens, but not if it's then going to.
Yeah, you wouldn't want that if it then starts raining rocks, which is the problem, even if it doesn't get burnt up in the atmosphere. But this is pretty cool. And this foundation, Lou, did we talk about Lou at the moment?
Yeah, so this group was set up following concerns from astronauts, including Ed Lou, who's a NASA astronaut. He flew space shuttle missions, stayed in the ISS. He set up a foundation which is building the Space Sentinel Telescope. It's an infrared device to give advance warning. He's hoping to have it in space by 2017, but in the meantime, he's encouraging the UN to practice asteroid deflection tactics.
What a fantastic thing to have to practice.
How do you practice?
Well, you play Space Invaders or asteroids.
Yeah.
it's basically that,
yeah.
Although slightly more high-tech, I think. I think this is fantastic. I mean, it's something that needs to happen because, as we've seen, I mean, the Tunguska example is a fantastic case of what happens when an asteroid hits the Earth. You basically get miles and miles and miles of land utterly devastated and destroyed. Obviously, I mean, we get impacted thousands and thousands of times every day. Earth, that is, not Tom, Nicholas, and I.
It's really painful all the time. By meteorites.
By things saying, yeah, but because of the amount of the Earth that's covered in ocean, most of these land in the sea. A lot of them are very small and land in forests. Sometimes they get burnt up in the atmosphere and things like that. But it is a daily basis. I mean, you'll have to look at the moon and look at how cratered that is. And that's basically the result of the same stuff that's happening to Earth. It's just we're covered in water. Well, we've got a story on the site if you want to read more about this and some of the plans to deflect asteroids on why.co.uk if you search for asteroids. Well, we're going to move into a new ad break, and you'll see why it's new in a few moments. But when we come back, we have a couple of great segments. We're going to talk about Tom's feature on what the huge influx of data and messaging are basically doing to our children's brains. And we're also going to hear straight away from Steve Wozniak. This episode of the Why.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Now, Squarespace offers free domain names, highly customized website designs, drag-and-drop tools, as well as 24/7 support in case you need any pointers or help building a site. And a neat feature is that seamless e-commerce integration means you can actually start taking money in a few minutes for physical goods or digital downloads, selling music, videos, written work, ebooks, things like that, and on responsive websites that are scaled to look good on computers or mobile devices. So if you're still running a website on WordPress or messing around with templates and having to keep them up to date, you should give this at least a go. You get a free trial today, you don't need a credit card, and as a Why.co.uk podcast listener, you get 10% off your first purchase by using the offer code WIRED10. If you go to squarespace.com/WIREDUK, you'll find everything there. Welcome back. And the first thing we're going to do is get into our segments. And the first of these segments is Ride the Technosaurus. Mm-hmm. Now, this week, we have double-saddled the Technosaurus because I am riding it with none other than Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple. And this took place at an interview that I did with him at Apps World, the conference that took place in London a few days ago. And we talked about many topics, about an hour and a half, but I picked out a few choice segments that we wanted to play to you today over the next 7 or 8 minutes. And the first question I asked was basically how Steve feels about the giant phones that we've been getting recently, like the 6-inch Lumias and the 5 to 6-inch Galaxy Notes.
That's probably a little large for me because, like, you come from the background of using cell phones where it was better to get them smaller and smaller and smaller before they had screens you had to read and you had to use for your input-output. So I think 6 inches might be a little large. On the other hand, Apple came out with an iPad mini at 7 inches, and I thought, wow, my Kindle is 7 inches, and it fits in my pocket with cell phones and all. It fits in actually nicely. And I could be wearing Kindle right now, and I thought, I want that. And then the iPad mini was just a hair too large. It's more like 8 inches, a little too large for my pocket. But if something fit in there, it would still be usable. But I think the Galaxy Note is probably the largest I'd want.
Do you think Apple will do a larger iPhone? I mean, it stayed basically the same size since its inception.
You know, I've been thinking they would a long time before this. As a matter of fact, they increased the size to the iPhone 5 from the iPhone 4, but they increased it in one dimension only. I think it would have been smarter to expand it and keep then the programmers would have one aspect ratio and you could just scale everything. I think that would have made a lot of sense, but Apple had already taken this defensive position of, how do you compare to these Android phones? You'd walk into a store, and every phone was large, and then the iPhone had the smallest screen of all. And that was a little disappointing. It was kind of like old days when you saw a whole bunch of brands of computers and only one Macintosh from Apple. It sets an image like, where is Apple in the game? And I wanted a large screen. I just don't know why they chose that. But Apple defensively said, you can operate an iPhone with one hand, and you can't operate the others with one hand. And, you know, sometimes everybody finds that's actually true and useful, but it's not a 100% thing.
So one of the emerging trends we're seeing at the moment is smartwatches and apps being developed for devices we're wearing on our wrists. Now, when you look at these smartwatches, we've seen some from Samsung, we've seen one from Sony, we've got the Pebble and things like that. Like, when you look at those, what do you see? Do you see a product that is actually a compelling idea?
Actually, yeah. What I think of smartwatches is, okay, some years ago, oh my gosh, my friend in Germany was wearing a watch that was a cell phone. Okay, it was a cell phone, not a smartwatch. And I got this iPod Nano, a couple years ago. I've been wearing it on every airplane flight, and I fly constantly. And I use it for music, and I listen to music the whole flight. And it's nice to scroll with my hand. I say, what a neat interface, scrolling rather than pushing buttons. I don't know. A lot of times, just the way things feel to your muscles really makes a huge difference, just like the iPad, scrolling it. And I thought, well, it's limited. It's only an iPod. I wish I had my whole smartphone here. As a matter of fact, I really want to ask it Siri questions and get answers to, you know, to difficult questions, you know, like, is the population of one country larger than that of another? And come up with an answer. So I wanted the smartphone. I've been talking about that for 2 years publicly, you know, that I envision a smartphone would be nice. But the trouble is now all the smartphones are taken off based on the iPod Nano, roughly this size. Sony, Qualcomm, Nokia, who else? Samsung. They're all coming out this size, and I expect there's going to be about 30 of them soon because it's a pretty easy technology to make. And how smart are they? Are they the complete phone, or do they have to link to your phone with Bluetooth to really use cellular at all? You know, is the cellular going to be built into it or external? It'll probably be external like Google Glass is now. But I've been saying I want a wearable phone. So I don't have to even reach in my pocket. I don't even want to carry my phone, though. I want the whole complete thing. Recently, though, I started saying, I don't like this small size for a phone. It doesn't have enough output device. It doesn't have enough for me to see what's going on, what I'm trying to get information about and to use and scroll through. It complicates my life too much being small. I want something closer to the size of, let's say, an iPhone today or whatever phone today. And that means a little larger on the wrist or something. Maybe it folds over your wrist to give you more square inches.
It wouldn't be fitting that we didn't ask something about Apple. It's actually quite conveniently timed, this interview today, because Apple announced a whole lot of new stuff. New iPads, new Macs, mm-hmm. new Mac Pros, things like that. Have you had a chance to take a look at those? Anything that sort of jumps out and says, wow,
Yeah, I am constantly following the gadget and the product world, and it's so important to me. And I'm always if I'm in town, I attend the events. I was invited. If I'm out of town, I'm watching the live blogs online. Well, I was on a plane all last night, so I missed it all. And when I got in, I looked at the products, and the iPads didn't hit my needs. Yes, thinner, lighter, smaller, totally good. That's just the new iPad. I don't think they're going to sell the old and the new, so it just replaces it. It's guaranteed high sales from day one. But the trouble is, I don't have broadband at home, and I travel so much. I'm in hotels.
Well, you don't have broadband at home.
No, and in hotels you don't have broadband. So I carry a lot of my personal media, a lot of the Big Bang Theory TV shows and videos and audio and all that. I like to carry it. And 128 gigabytes for the current iPad. I was hoping Apple would have a 256 gigabyte version so I could put all the seasons of the Big Bang Theory on one iPad. But it didn't come out. That was all I looked for and said. So I emailed my wife. Nope, don't want one of those. But they upped they did up the MacBook Pro, which is the heart of my life for computing, especially since I type a lot in Dvorak, avoiding my fingers having to move a long distance. And they upped it to a terabyte instead of 3/4 of a terabyte for the built-in solid-state disk. So that one hit a sweet spot. You asked one question about something.
Probably about you not having broadband at home, which is hugely surprising. What sort of parallels do you draw between, say, the early days of Apple, those sort of first garage months, and today's sort of startup scene and new developers?
When we started Apple, our business was accidental. Steve Jobs just wanted to have a successful company, and he did all the business on the phone, you know, ordering parts and getting sales and getting publicity. One thing that I do see is publicity matters a lot. We had a lot of publicity because nobody was against us. No big companies thought our personal computers were going to be successful in that early startup phase. So all the press was hot on this neat story, including two kids starting in a garage, but the whole idea of little computers that would be in your own home was a hot story until they became very successful, and then the big companies sort of had to respond as competitors more. And today, you almost start out, and it's such a huge market for everything. You've almost got to think, oh my gosh, I've got competition from the start, and what am I trying to do? Are you also I think that apps, are you trying to do something? When we started Apple, we started with a really advanced product. I hate to say it, the Apple II, but it was all of the revenues and profits of Apple for the first 10 years of the company. We went through failures of the Apple III, the Lisa, and the Macintosh trying to build other computers, and we just failed over and over. And we had to actually modify the Macintosh and market it heavily to get it to sell for 3 years after Steve Jobs left. It was by the people that he disdained that made it finally go. We believed it was the future, but the market was a lot tougher to face now. Marketing's the most important thing.
So joining a company, one good way to make money. Starting a company is another great way. Another way, this sort of cuts right to the heart of the thing, is to just print your own cash, which you have done.
Not exactly. There's a printer in my hometown of Los Gatos, California, and he makes pads of cash for me, and every page of the pad has four $2 bills. $2 is the most unusual bill in the United States. I like to do unusual things. And they're all perforated, so you tear them off like stamps. Turns out that these bills, they meet the specs of the U.S. government. This printer gets the supplies from a high-quality printer. They meet the specs of the U.S. government. By law, that makes them legal tender. I should have brought one here to show, because I have one in my hotel. I thought about it. And that's all you have to do. I don't know if it's the right president on the bills. You look at it, and you'll say the serial numbers are the same on every bill. How can that be legal? And the Secret Service is in charge of money in the United States, the counterfeit money. The Secret Service has approved my bills 3 times. 2 of the times they actually saw the bills. And 1 time they read me what's called my Miranda rights, which is what you get read before you're arrested. And when they did that, I was thinking, you know, when they said they're going to read the Miranda rights to me, I thought, two can play this game. So I gave them a fake ID that said I was a laser safety officer with an eye patch in the picture, and they bought it. But they approved them, and yes, so they're legal tender, and I sell a sheet. I always sell a sheet of, everywhere I go, I sell a sheet of $4 $2 bills for $5 to anybody who wants to buy them. And I will tell you the truth, they do not cost me $4, $8 for four of them.
And you can actually take these into shops and spend them?
Yes, I've been doing it for 20 years. They're totally legal tender. Yeah, no question. Yeah, everything I've said is totally true, including the Secret Service.
So,
and the fake ID. That fake ID, by the way, I used it for every airplane flight for 5 years of my life. Because I was able to afford such a high-quality printer, I could print photo IDs when the rest of the world with home computers couldn't print anything that looked like a photo. I had a dye sublimation printer, and I'd make fake concert passes, you know, the thing. But I had this, I based this on a Department of Defense card, but I changed the wording to Department of Defiance, but your brain never sees that. Your brain sees Department of Defense. But then if they ever caught me, I'd say it's not a fake card, it's a joke card. And they never caught me. 5 years, every airplane flight in my life. Laser safety officer with an eye patch.
Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Wozniak.
That was Steve Wozniak there, co-founder of Apple. I hope you enjoyed that. We were speaking at Apps World Europe a few days ago, and Apps World has another event coming up. I think the next one is in San Francisco on the 5th to 6th of February. If you want to head over to there for some of the other keynote speakers, I won't be there, which is a shame, but other people will. Go to apps-world.net and you'll find out who is going to be there. Segment two in the second half of the show, and this is, oh no, they didn't. The UK court has ordered ISPs to block another 21 file-sharing sites, and this follows blocks for things like the Pirate Bay and Kickass Torrents. The recent closure as well of ISO Hunt was in the news. And this is the result of the British Recording Music Industry, the BPI. Actually, that stands for British...
Phonographic
industry, yeah. I think, which has basically said that we need to shut these sites down because they're illegal. And the list includes some really big names like Files Tube and BitSnoop, Extra Torrent, Manova, Torrent Hound, Torrent Reactor, and Torrents.eu. So these sites were blocked on various ISPs, Virgin Media being one of them, I suspect. I haven't tested yet, unfortunately, but they're going to be blocked on the 30th of October. And what's really interesting about this, I think, is that these aren't just BitTorrent sites. So we've obviously seen a lot of closures of sites like Mega Upload was obviously a very, very high profile one. But some of these sites aren't indexing BitTorrent files at all. They're actually searching the competitors to what Mega Upload was, you know, things like MediaFire and RapidShare. And so FilesTube, for one example, is a site that lets you search about, I don't know, 50 or 60 different sites, including things like Dropbox, for pirated content, but also legitimate content. And Torrents, which is Torrents with a Z rather than an S at the end, is sort of an aggregator of aggregators. So it searches the databases of websites that index torrents that exist from around the web. So it's another really interesting one to see close. And 21 in one go.
So the BPI is saying that anything that lets you find pirated content is itself illegal.
Yeah.
So
which is ridiculous because that's Google then.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Google, you can probably find about, I've read a report that 80% of infringing URLs on these websites can actually be found through Google. And Google itself operates under the DMCA, so it gets notified if it's inadvertently linking to other things. But there's a great and very, very easy way to find pirated content on the web. Go onto Google, search for whatever you want, add torrent to the end of it, and you'll find a whole load of pages. And if you're... Here's a pro tip. If you, and I don't do this, but if you want to do this...
We don't condone this, by the way.
We don't condone this at all. But Google caches these sites. Now, your ISP will block the pages they're caching, but they don't block the cache itself. So if you do a search and you find this link on Kickass Torrents or what have you, and click the cached icon, Google will then give you the cached version of that page, which includes the link to the torrent file, and that way you're circumventing all of these blocks. And the reason I wanted to point this out is because it highlights how fundamentally pointless a lot of these blocks are.
Yeah, and another thing that highlights that as well is if you search for a particular film you want to watch on Google and just stick download on the end of it, it'll give you a whole list of links. A lot of them have been removed, but if you look at the very bottom, it says we have had to remove some of these links because they breach certain copyright laws, blah, blah, blah. Click here to see the results that have been removed.
Yeah.
So you can see them, and then you can go straight. They don't stop you going to those links. They just say you ought not to do this. Really,
it's very bizarre, but I think that, I mean, in a way, I mean, these sites are providing pretty easy access to infringing content. But the thing is, I'm getting, with every passing month, I'm getting less and less annoyed by these closures, because I hear far fewer people these days complaining about these things being closed down and far more people talking about the legitimate services that they're now using. Because, I mean, the movie and TV industry has not caught up, but with music, actually, there's never been a better time to not be needing to pirate content. Yeah. So much more of the problem is actually record labels who release stuff digital only or digital first and give geographic regional blocks to access. So if they release it on iTunes US, it might not be available in iTunes UK, even though it's being released digitally. That's far more of a problem. And actually, they're providing access, they're providing their music to a lot more sources than ever before.
Yeah, I kind of actually disagree about the TV and film. Like, I love Netflix, and it's just so convenient and has most of the shows I like.
It does, but Netflix, I mean, it's fine if you want to watch the 1980s series of Care Bears, which they recently added. But if you want to watch any of the new stuff, it's kind of like the Blockbuster bargain bin. And I love it. I agree. And I pay for Netflix too, and it's a brilliant service. I really do like it. But it's not the go-to service to find the latest episodes of, you know, The Simpsons or something or anything like that.
Yeah. I think they also need to sort out their region locking or whatever they're calling it, where basically if you've got the US Netflix, you've got a hell of a lot more shows. And it just seems quite arbitrary. I don't know why.
It's because they have to work out with the content every territory. So like if a film's released there, they have to negotiate for the rights there. It's a real pain in the ass.
It is. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about 80 years of legacy rights agreements that's slowly being eroded, but it's taken... You know, things like, obviously, with music, Napster in the early days. These days, it's, you know, not necessarily YouTube, but similar sorts of sites to order to get them into gear. And the first thing they do is they litigate. And if they can't do that, then they, you know, they try and block at this sort of level. And after that, they start negotiating. And that's when you start seeing the interesting services arise, like, you know, obviously Spotify and iTunes and Netflix. And we'll see where that goes. But that's happening. Thought you should know. Well, last up on the show today, last but very certainly not least, Tom Cheshire is going to talk to us about his cover story. Now, this is in the new issue of Wired. It's out, well, it's out by the time anyone hears this, since we're publishing it on Thursday, and that's when the magazine goes on sale. Now, what's the top line to this? What's the cover line? We called it Distracted.
Yeah.
Question mark.
How hyperstimulation is making you smarter.
Is it making us smarter? Is the influx of messages I get from WhatsApp, from Google Hangouts, from Twitter...
Yeah, it's probably making you dumber and me dumber, but the argument that it's making our kids dumber is maybe less true. So, you know, you get people like the Baroness Susan Greenfield saying, Facebook home will rot your children's brains. This is your brain on social media. And there's very little evidence to actually support this. And one of the reasons for this is because it's so new. No one's done these proper longitudinal studies like they have for TV or video games, which we know pretty well. They haven't done it for social media. But we think, there's sort of emerging reports coming from around the world that's pointing to some of the sort of positive influences and the idea that kids are actually sort of better at handling this than we are. Not because they're digital natives, which is one of the worst terms ever invented. They're not. They have to learn this stuff, but they might be better at learning it and sort of developing strategies for coping with this information. But we need to help them out a lot more than we are at the moment.
And what about things like sort of daily distraction? Well, it's not even daily, it's minute by minute distractions. I mean, there was a figure in your piece about 6 minutes. Like, that's the 6 minutes. Was that to do with how easily it is for them to get distracted from homework as a result?
Yeah, this is a study carried out in America, which really, really good study. And it said just they got some kids doing some homework and they just measured how long it took them to stop doing their homework. And the average, even when they've been told to concentrate, was 6 minutes before a technological distraction took their attention elsewhere.
Now, this isn't like that classic marshmallow test, where if you put a marshmallow in front of a kid and say, you can't eat this for 5 minutes, but if you don't eat it in 5 minutes, you can get two afterwards.
It's kind of like that, actually. It's a digital version of that. And, you know, kids tear themselves in pieces with the marshmallow test. I mean, I would point out that homework is intrinsically boring and it's easy to get distracted by. So that's not a new problem. It's just made it easier to get distracted. But it's important. So self-control, like you mentioned with the marshmallow test, it's important for children to develop it. They always have less of it than adults do. That's why they're children. They're impulsive. But it's not easy when you have so many demands on the attention. So we need to sort of come up with strategies, and they're doing this too, that that sort of make you aware of where your attention is, of what your task is, and being quite ruthless about that. But it seems like they're sort of doing this. They've looked at us stumbling around streets, like heads in, buried in smartphones, and thought, like, what are these people doing? Why are they friending people on Facebook? They hate Facebook. And they're sort of saying they want something better and a bit of a rejection of that.
And what, I mean, when we talk about distractions, it, the image that it comes into my head is when you're reading a book and your phone is off, you can focus more. You're not getting distracted, but you're also not necessarily thinking quite as hard about, oh, I'll just you know, turn the screen on to see if there's any updates there. Are we talking here about people just getting messages, or are we talking about an intrinsic desire to see what has changed in the digital world? I mean, is which side of that argument are we talking about here in terms of distraction?
I think in terms of distraction, it's the go-to setting. So that kids always have this stuff running. So they'll be doing their homework while on Skype and Minecraft at the same time, doing this all together. And they're kind of like juggling, like keeping pots cooking. So it's less being like physically distracted from something, like although that is part of it, it's more sort of managing your attention, dividing your attention. The term that's used a lot is multitasking, which is something that doesn't exist. Humans can't multitask. So many, many studies have shown that it's really, really impossible unless you're a supertasker, which is about 3% of the population, in which case, well done. The rest of us can't do it. We switch our attention between things. And every time we switch our attention, that has a cognitive cost. It's like reloading a web page. It takes a while. So you become less efficient. And there have been studies showing that multitaskers are actually worse at multitasking than people who don't tend to do multitasking. Like, it just rots their brains.
And what if you had to pick sort of what your conclusion is out of this study? Because I mean, it's a big feature. And what is it, 4,000 words, something like that?
Yeah,
it's a huge feature. I mean, what was the number one thing that you learned during your reporting on this?
Well, I really think it's that the kids are developing ways of managing their attention. They're doing it by themselves, and that, you know, they'll do these super log-offs on Facebook where they'll just completely shut it down until next time they log on. They'll be very mindful about where their attention is, or they'll order tasks. So rather than, like you say, being distracted by a text message or a Snapchat coming in, they'll see it come in and they'll put it in a queue and queue it like that and actually have a very good running order of their digital lives. It's amazing they've got so far. What we need to be doing is, rather than saying digital media is bad for you, you shouldn't be spending so much time on it, and castigating them, we should be sort of putting it actually in the heart of schools and saying, like, look, here's how to use digital media in a mindful way. Here's how it's useful. Here's where it's not good. And doing that rather than banning it from schools completely, where you will develop bad habits and you will, yeah, probably develop worse as a result.
It sounds to me more like the students are actually better off placed as teachers for us.
Yeah,
because I mean, I'm constantly distracted by updates and notifications, and I've really tried to instigate this rule where I turn my email off at certain points in the day, and I turn the notification on my iPad. I've turned email notification off, so when I'm reading, rather than having a little ticker at the top, you know, every sort of 15-20 seconds coming in a new email, which is about how frequently it tends to be at the moment, I have to actually go into that email app, and I find that makes a tangible difference to the stress that I feel when reading. Like, just hearing that ping, I know there's a new email. Just having that ticket, it's always reminding me of email. Turning that off actually makes me more relaxed when reading. Yeah. And I'm guessing this is something that these kids are doing kind of as second nature, rather than me, which was, I'm really pissed off at how much this is distracting me. I need to get rid of it and figure it out.
And I think the difference is that, you know, this is new to us. I grew up with a sort of dial-up modem, and, you know, I did Encarta. That's how I found information.
Good old Encarta.
Encarta was great. It wasn't great. But now, so, I mean, it's new to me, this whole, like, Snapchat's new, everything's new, bombardment, and we have sucked at it because we've just jumped in without thinking about it. If they've grown up in it a bit more, I think there's a bit more of an ability to take the benefits of it, and sort of see how, especially adults using it, because that's how kids learn stuff, is by watching adults use it and sort of reframing their own behaviors as well. I would emphasize that not everyone does this. There are still going to be people who die playing World of Warcraft as teenagers, and get really hooked in the same way people get hooked on everything. But it seems like there might be a slight generational shift in this.
Really interesting. Well, Tom's feature is out in the new issue of Wired. You can recognize it by the cover of about 50 different social network messaging icons on the cover. That's out now on iPad, on iPhone, actually, funnily enough. We've just moved to iPhone. Well, that's going to do for this week. Liv and Leah, I promise will maybe be back next week, depending on whether I look at the calendar ahead of recording a podcast or not. So listen to them then. You can follow us, obviously, Wired UK on Twitter, Wired UK on Facebook, Wired UK on Google+. And any comments, questions, feedback, hate mail, rants, loves, marriage proposals for Tom, all that sort of stuff can come to podcast@wired.co.uk. And we will see you next week.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.
Do actually.
You do. You've got a face for TV and a voice, and a voice for radio.
You charmer.